And it is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, your host, introducing you once again this week to our favorite co-host. That would be Peg Webb, senior financial advisor with Wealth Enhancement Group and the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, Bruce Helmer. Welcome to both of you. It's going to be a fun show. It's an Ask Both of You Anything question. Those are always good shows, aren't they, guys?
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce. And yes, we are going to have to be on our toes today. Bruce?
Yeah, well, Susie, I usually like to call this Ask Peg Anything because as frequent listeners to the show will know, Peg is infinitely smarter than I am. But I'll try to chime in with something, make a contribution here and there. But yeah, we'll get as many listener questions in today as we can. But before we do that, and I know you want to pump the numbers and get it going, Susie, but Peg and I wanted to circle back on a question that somebody had on a recent show, and we didn't get a chance to get to it. We did a show where we were talking about difficult conversations, and we got a lot of feedback from people about what a unique and important and interesting topic that was. But somebody wrote us and said, and quoting here, "Great topic today. My parents never want to talk about money. Long story short, we put mom in a senior facility, and dad's pension pays for half the monthly rent. Mom wants to start giving $15,000 to two family members, but I'm worried about taking the money. If she outlives her money, I feel like it'll come back to us if she becomes a ward of the state," end quote. So there's not really a question there. It's kind of illustrating a potential situation and a concern. But Peg, this is not an uncommon thing that we run into in our practice, right, Peg?
No, it isn't at all. And, you know, it's interesting because people feel like they've got some wealth and they want to share it with their children and grandchildren. We see this often. But what happens is we don't have that crystal ball for how long we're going to live. You know, if you are going to be going into a senior living facility and then possibly, you know, higher and higher need of care, which is very, very expensive. So in this situation, these aging parents gifting to children is very common, and they come to us and ask us, can I afford to do that? Well, we're assuming here, I'm kind of just assuming that the dad is still alive, but he might not be. There is a pension, so it could be his pension, but it could be a survivor pension. A lot of the clients still take what's called a joint and survivor pension, meaning that if something were to happen to the person who had the pension, let's say here in this case it was the dad, he would say, let's say he has $25,000 a year or something like that. Joint and survivor just means that if you are the survivor, you would take, you're taking 50% of what's left. Not many people take a full pension that's guaranteed for the second person that's alive, like the $25,000, they take joint and survivor. So in that case, if he is still alive but he passes away, then there's a loss of some of that pension. Nursing homes, if you get to that level, then it's very, very expensive. You have to remember that they both probably have Social Security that's coming in, and if one passes away, the higher of the two will go to the surviving person. And then if you have a nest egg of some type, cash, stocks, real estate, bonds, that kind of thing, you probably are generating some type of income on that money. And right now, we can still get money markets at about 4%, maybe a little bit higher. But money markets, let's just remember, they're priced daily. So the change of interest rate can change throughout your lifetime. So we can't necessarily say that we're going to get 4% return. But in the past, we've been able to get something like 3 to 4% over time for people. So what I would say is that if you do gift that money, then there's this ugly thing called the give back. So if you do run out of money and you gifted a bunch of money, then you actually have 60-month look back as far as Medicaid is concerned. So, Bruce, as I was just going on and on, there's a lot to consider in how we coach our clients. What we do is we want to make them aware of the gotchas. If you give your money away, you know, early, just be prepared that there might be some repercussions of doing that. Bruce?
No, Peg, I don't feel like you went on and on. I thought that was actually a great answer. I'm only going to add a little bit. You mentioned the five-year look back. I think that's what they were referring to when they said, I feel like it will come back to us. And then they said, if she becomes a ward of the state. I think what they mean by a ward, if somebody's out of money, we live in a country where we don't throw elderly people into the street. They will still be taken care of, but they will be, if they run out of money, they're eligible for something called medical assistance or Medicaid, not Medicare, Medicaid. So they will still be taken care of. But in that case, they will look back 5 years and see where the assets went. And if the gifts were made less than 5 years ago, the person that asked the question is correct. They may come to you for that money. But if the gifts were made more than 5 years ago, you shouldn't have anything to worry about. And the other thing, Peg, that I would add, there are planning opportunities here to be sure. And we can do a lot of it, but there's also some technical things that you really need an attorney, and not just any attorney. We often refer our clients to something called an elder care attorney in these situations. So we have a lot of expertise to help, but this can get complex enough that even we don't, we can't practice law. You and I are not attorneys. We have attorneys on our team at Wealth Enhancement Group, but this is a very specialized part of the law, and we often refer clients to elder care attorneys. Anything to add, Peg, or should we throw it back to Susan?
No, I think that was great.
Okay. All right. Very good. If you have a question for Bruce or Peg, this is your opportunity to do it. It's kind of an open line. Anything that comes to your mind, 651-461-9226. Again, that number here in the studio is 651-461-9226. Texter writes this morning, could you please explain the Rockefeller effect? Bruce or Peg?
Peg, you've used that phrase on the show, the Rockefeller effect.
Well, that's actually a Peg Webb quote. I'm kind of smiling and laughing right now because I always use that as the Rockefellers, to me, in my mind, were very wealthy, and they started generations ago. And what they did is they continued to just pass along their wealth to the next generation, next generation, next generation. And I call that the Rockefeller effect because it's kind of like a snowball at the top of the mountain. And as it comes down or you hand more money to the family heirs, the estate just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the IRS is trying to control that. And they're trying to control that by taxing you while you're alive. And I use it mostly with Roth conversions. Or IRA dollars where they continue to compound. I see it all the time where people are not spending their IRA dollars. And so they end up dying with those IRA dollars. So the IRS came out with that 10 years. So what they want is they want the account to be empty in 10 years, whether it's a traditional taxable IRA. Or they've included now the Roth IRAs that grow tax-free if you follow all the rules. So that's why I use the dramatic term of the Rockefeller effect.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think a younger generation might relate to it more if we said the Musk effect or the Gates effect or the Buffett effect. But a lot of people younger than you and I, Peg, don't know who the Rockefellers were, but yeah, that was a really good answer. That's where I've heard, when we use that phrase, people often have asked me, why do I have to spend a Roth IRA if it's not taxed anyway? And it gets back to they don't want this multi-generational in perpetuity rolling over of money generation over generation. They want to get it back circulated into the economy and stimulate the economy, even if they aren't going to take taxes on it. So that may be where they've heard that phrase. If you and I have used it, it's usually been in that context. Susan?
All right, 651-461-9226. We have Barb on our line. Barb calling from Anoka, Minnesota. Go ahead, Barb. You're on with Bruce and Peg.
Hello. I have a question about my 401. If I take a loan out of my 401 and I turn 59 and a half this coming year, do I still have to pay the full amount, or because I know at 59 and a half you can take out some money at your 401? Is that true?
Hey, Barb, thank you for listening, and thank you for calling and asking a really, really good question. And it's good for a lot of reasons, but I think it's something that a lot of people would be interested in understanding, and it pertains to a lot of people. So, Peg, Barb is right. 59 and a half is kind of a magic age, but there's a difference between taking a loan on your 401k versus just taking a withdrawal from your 401k. So there's probably a lot of different side streets we can take on this question. Peg?
Yeah, when you take a loan from your company plan, and I'm assuming you're still gainfully employed, because if you did retire or you left that job, one of the big negatives is you have to pay off that principal that you borrowed. Well, in the same case, if you took a loan out of your 401k, what they do, if you're gainfully employed, they take out the payments out of your paycheck. So you're not physically, you know, sending in money to pay off that loan. If you turn 59 and a half, it isn't like that loan, those loan payments just stop. You always, always have the ability to go pay off your loan. And since you are not taking out, if you want to, you'd have to go and pay it back. So let's say that you want to start a new loan, but if you're 59 and a half, you probably wouldn't do that. You would just take out a withdrawal. Now you have to watch out too, because if it is a company plan, they all have terms and conditions that you have to follow. So even taking a withdrawal out of a active 401k, you'd have to check with your human resources department to see, you know, how you would do that. Bruce?
Yeah, Peg, that's excellent so far. I'm going to add a little bit to your question, Barb. Peg, a lot of times over the years, people have come to me with this idea of borrowing against their company retirement plan, whether it's a 401k or whatever it is. And my attitude has always been, it's kind of a last resort. That's meant to be for your retirement. If you really, 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 really are in a pinch and you need money and that's the last place to go, I would never say never, but I really don't like to see people doing that. People give me the argument, I'd rather borrow from myself than go to some financial institution and have to pay an interest cost for the use of money. Isn't it more efficient to borrow out of my own retirement plan? And there's some truth to that, but there's a lot of potential pitfalls if something goes wrong. What if you have that loan and you lose your job and you can't pay it back? Then suddenly that entire amount that you borrowed is treated as a premature distribution, subject to income taxes, subject to maybe premature distribution penalties. Maybe there's interest on the loan because you're late in paying it back. So it's just, it can create a whole magnitude of different problems. So again, there are times where maybe we would say that's appropriate, but I would really, really, really discourage people. I really feel strongly that any retirement plan, whether it's your company plan or an individual retirement account or a Roth IRA, really, really, really try to encourage and coach my clients to leave those plans alone. They're there for your retirement, and try not to touch them before 59 and a half at the earliest. Barb, and Peg, anything else to add for Barb?
Well, the only thing I would say is I frown on it just because it's a long-term asset, right? And if you just think about it now, like how well the stock market has done and the missed opportunity that you would have had just leaving that money in that 401k, might have been better to go to the bank and borrow some money at a particular interest rate. So it's just looking back, would that be the best idea? So I try to discourage people from taking those loans.
That's such a great point, too, because, again, somebody doesn't want to pay interest. Let's say you go take a loan, the interest rate is 6 or 7%, and you say, gosh, I'm paying 6 or 7% where I wouldn't have had to. But you're right. If you take that money out of your plan and it's been earning 10 or 12 or even 15% in recent years, the market's done really well. There's a huge lost opportunity cost there where it actually economically, even if you don't default on the loan, even if you don't have any problems, it was more costly to do that than to just pay a financial institution some interest. So, yeah, Again, there's times where maybe you have to do it, but Peg and I would both agree we would really, really, really see that as probably a last resort. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. That is the call, the number to call right now if you have a question for Bruce or for Peg, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, what is your opinion on investing in cryptocurrency? Is that the same as Bitcoin, Bruce or Peg?
Yeah, so Bitcoin, Susie and listeners, is one of the possible types of cryptocurrency or cyber currency. And we are getting this question a lot, Peg. How do you address it with people when you get it?
Well, I have done zero, nothing with crypto, meaning advising it. One of the things that we run into, Bruce, is compliance. And there's a lot of compliance around this new way of investing. And we have just been kind of staying back on investing in it because of those rules and regulations that continue to come out. I'm going to throw it back to you, Bruce.
Well, yeah, it's not federally regulated yet, which is what one of the reasons it's appealing to people. So, Susie and Peg and listeners, what I generally tell people is that money is money because we say it's right. Okay, we haven't been on a gold standard with gold backing money since like 1972. So money is money because we've decided it is, and we can decide anything is money. And in the future, money might be crypto. It might not be paper dollars and the way people of our generation peg the way we've always seen money. But I don't know that it's going to be Bitcoin, right? And the example I give to people is, when the automobile was invented, we knew we were never going to go back to horse and buggy. But there at one time was over 100 automobile companies that people invested in, and today, like three of them survived. So if you invested in Edsel stock in the 1930s or whatever, you lost your money. So I don't think cryptocurrency is ever going to go away. I don't know what it will look like in the future. But I don't know that Bitcoin is going to be what we use. It might be a cryptocurrency or a cyber currency we haven't even heard of yet, that because the one that gets used and ultimately gets regulated by the federal government. But Peg, this idea, and you mentioned our compliance, the idea that financial transactions will not someday somehow be regulated by the federal government is naive, because if it becomes that prevalent, the government's going to get involved and there's going to be regulations, which right now there kind of isn't. It's so new. It's so not understood. And I'll be the first to tell you, I don't fully understand it. I've invested a little bit in it and I've done okay in it, but it's certainly not something that everybody should do. And if you really, 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 really want to do it, I tell people it should not be more than 10% of your overall investable assets, because it's too risky to take a chance any bigger than that. But if you really, really want to do it, I wouldn't discourage it. Just be careful how big you go. Susie, do we have time to sneak in one more question in the first half?
Yeah, I think so. This texter writes, can Bruce and Peg please share the different risks between a mutual fund and an ETF that trades mutual fund shares?
Really, really astute question. Peg, a little less than 2 minutes, I think, to talk about traditional mutual funds versus exchange-traded funds.
Yeah, I think of them in being one in the same. One of the things about exchange-traded funds is with a mutual fund, you see the actual shares and you see the actual fund. With an exchange-traded fund, it's something that was developed using the same method as mutual funds, but yet you don't see all the detail of what's in the exchange-traded fund. Bruce?
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that people sometimes ask me is why we don't use more ETFs. We still have a lot of traditional no-load funds in our managed portfolios, And the first thing is they're relatively new, so it's hard to see a performance history. And again, past performance won't guarantee future results, but we like to see, you know, a longer history before we pick a fund. But secondly, there's just not that many of them yet that we can't always diversify a portfolio the way we want using only ETFs. So I think they're becoming more and more prevalent. We're using them more and more in our managed portfolios, but I don't know if they will ever completely, totally replace the traditional mutual fund. And again, one of the advantages presumably of ETFs is lower cost, and we are cost conscious. When we do our fund selection in our portfolios, cost is one of the things that we consider, but it's certainly not the only thing we consider. Cost is only an issue in the absence of value. What do we get for the cost? Can we do a cost-benefit analysis and determine that there are features and benefits or things about a manager that it's worth a little bit of extra cost and will give us a better net-net? So, yeah, I know we're about due for a break.
We surely are. And let's take this opportunity to remind people listening, we've got a whole nother second half of the show, and the number to call is 651-461-9226. That is the talk and text line. Love to hear from you if you have a question. We have a lot of text questions up that we'll get to after this. You are listening to Your Money. And the number to call if you have a question for them after the program is 1-888. Your Money. We'll be back right after. No, it's 1-888-6-ADVICE. We're back after this. And welcome back to the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Elmer and Peg Webb. It is a great show, a great opportunity to ask Bruce and Peg anything. Welcome back, Bruce and Peg. Shall we get right to questions, or do you want to jump in with any follow-up thoughts before we move on, Peg or Bruce?
Hey, Susie, thank you. I think Peg wanted to go back. If you joined us late, listeners, or missed the last part of the first half of the show, we had a question about traditional mutual funds and exchange-traded funds, and we covered it pretty well. But Peg, there was something else that you wanted to add to it yet.
Yes, since the show is live, and I'm thinking as fast as I can, I just thought of it when I handed it back. I went, wait a minute, there's something that's super important about ETFs versus mutual funds, and that is mutual funds, we all get the price at the end of the day. So let me give you an example. If I have a client call in at 9 a.m. and they want to sell some shares of a mutual fund, they will wait. They have to wait till the end of the day. If somebody calls me at noon, they have to wait till the end of the day. Well, with exchange-traded funds, that client that called at 9 a.m. and wanted to sell some, I was able to put in the ticket or the sell ticket right then and there. So I wanted to bring that up because that's a major difference with a mutual fund versus an ETF and the liquidity thereof. That was, I thought, was important, Bruce.
Yeah, I'm glad you added that. ETFs trade like an individual security in real time. Mutual funds don't, and that may seem like a small thing, but the price per share of a fund sometimes can change a lot in a single day, so that's not an insignificant point. Hey, Susie, before we get back to listener questions, I had one thing I wanted to make sure we got to today, Peg. A lot of clients are asking me, you know, on previous shows and maybe even yet again this year before we get to the end of the year, we're going to probably talk a little bit about holiday spending and staying within a budget. And when you get your credit card bill in the mail in January, you should be able to pay the balance. If you can't pay the balance and you're paying interest, you should avoid that. So I wanted to be proactive, and a lot of people are asking me, do you have any tips or any coaching on how to be smart about your holiday shopping and prevent yourself from overspending? Because people end up overspending just because they're generous and they're nice and they're loving and they want to give nice gifts. But you got to you know, stay within your means. And I don't want to see people paying, you know, high interest costs just for their generosity. So any thoughts or ideas on being smart about holiday spending?
Yeah, I think, you know, I witness that when times are good, people are more generous, right? Our statements are higher. You know, you feel confident about your employment, and people just spend when you feel like you have the ability to. the opposite happens when things are not going well, the market's down or you lost your job or things like that, then you have to cut back. I actually believe families fully understand that too, because I've, over the decades of time, I've been high, low, high, low. I do also see some impulse shopping, you know, like on that Black Friday or, you know, those, the days that you get all these discounts. I find that, wow, people really did spend. And by the way, there was 7% more sales on those days, the Cyber Day and the Black Friday this year than there was. And it doesn't shock me because things are good. People are in a positive mood. And so I highly encourage people not to use credit cards unless you are able to pay it back very quickly. I mean, they're double-digit returns, and it's just not necessary to go out and give the banks, if you will, that kind of payment. So, and then there's also gifts that you can make that are so personal and that you created or that you made. I mean, I can't tell you. It's unbelievable to get that kind of gift where you know that people really were thoughtful and took time, and it doesn't have to be expensive. Bruce?
I love the last point you made, Peg. If I think back, and I'm old, so it's hard for me to remember all of my Christmases, but if I think back to memories of Christmas gifts or holiday gifts that I received that are memorable, that meant a lot to me, that I still think about now, it's those types of things. It's those memories. It's those personal things. It's those thoughtful ideas. And you're right. They don't have to be expensive. I think a lot of people think, you know, to give a loving gift and to give a good gift, you have to spend a lot of money, but you really don't. So, yeah. So again, just, be smart. It's fine to be generous. It's good to be generous. Just be smart. I hate when people get those invoices or get those credit card bills in January, and if you can't pay the balance and now you're paying interest, I really want people to try to avoid that if they can. So be smart. Well, I'm sure we'll talk more about that a little bit again for the end of the year. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. This texter writes, hello, I'm planning on retiring in May of 2025 at the age of 65. I will have a pension, but I also work a second job. I'm planning on taking Social Security in May. How much can I work without losing Social Security money? And is there a monthly or yearly limit? And secondly, does my W-2 income through May count toward that SSI yearly limit? Thank you.
So, Peg, this is a really astute question because they understand, and what they're talking about, I'll kind of set it up for you and for listeners. What the texter's asking about is, with Social Security, you really have like an 8-year window of when you can draw it. You can draw it as early as age 62, but you would never wait beyond age 70 because the benefit doesn't appreciate or grow anymore. But in that 8-year window, there's something called full retirement age. That's when you're eligible for what Social Security calls full benefits. That's also the age in which you could still have a job and make as much money as you want and still draw your Social Security without any detrimental impact. But if you do start to draw it after the age of 62, but before you reach full retirement age, then you're limited on how much you can earn per year without creating a detrimental impact to your Social Security benefit. Now, some people might be confused, like, you know, what's the age? What's full retirement? And it depends upon when you were born. So if you were born prior to 1954, your full retirement age is 66. If you were born 1960 or later, then your full retirement age is 67. If you were born between 54 and 60, as I was, then your full retirement age is 66 years and some months. I was born in 1959, so my full retirement age is 66 years and 10 months. If I draw Social Security before that, and I make too much money, it can be a big no-no. So, Peg, do you want to dive into that a little bit deeper for us?
Well, you set that up really, really well. I encourage and have encouraged in the past that you would not take Social Security if you're under full retirement age and working, because the dollar amount, and it changes every year, the Social Security Administration says, okay, if you make over $22,320 in 2024, then for every dollar that you get in Social Security, you have to give back for every two that you earn. So what happens is it's a royal pain to have that happen. So you either have to try to stay under that number or not take Social Security. Bruce?
Yeah, and I would say the texter, 65 is too young to retire anyway. I'm kidding. I'm 65 and I have no interest in retiring. But no, it's a very astute question. And again, the key there is, and you know, he says he's 65 in May, but I don't know based on the text exactly what year he was born. So the full retirement age for the texter is going to be 66 years and some months. If you were born in 58, it's 66 years and 8 months. If you're born in 59, 66 and 10, and so on. So once you hit full retirement age, then you don't have anything to worry about. You can make as much money as you want on your part-time job. So I would encourage the texter to wait before you draw until you hit what they call full retirement age, if you can find out what that is. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, I'm 40 years old with $32,000 in debt in a consolidated loan. I'm thinking of cashing in my 401k at about $50,000 to pay off the debt. The debt is affecting my mental health, and I just want a fresh start. My friends have suggested I need to get a loan against my 401k, and then I considered that debt. Do you have some advice for me? And we did talk about this a little earlier, but this is a feeling you have. You just want to clean it all up and be done. But you guys talk about the downside of that.
Yeah, thank you, Susie, and thank you whoever sent the question. And Peg, before I throw it to you to give what I know will be a really good answer, I just want to say that it is not lost on us as financial advisors that the decisions you make financially are not all just economically logical. Emotion comes into play here. Your feelings, your ability to sleep at night. We understand that. So I like what the texter said, that you know, this is just, you know, a lot of pressure and a lot of stress and weighing them down. It's not just an economic thing, because, you know, economically there could be plus and minuses to what they're talking about doing, but you also have to consider that emotional component. And I don't know how you quantify what that is, but I know it's very, very real, and we're not insensitive to that when we try to advise clients. You know, Peg, the advice we give to clients is not based on the shoes that you and I walk in. We try to put ourselves in the client's shoes and their situation and advise them based on what their economic reality is, not ours, not anybody else's. But with that as kind of a setup, you want to go into some specifics of what you might tell this person?
Yes. Once again, decades of time. I feel, and I kind of got goosebumps when I was hearing about it, because there's a lot of people out there that are in this situation where I have no idea why you have $32,000 worth of debt at 40 years old, but you get into these circumstances that a lot of times are beyond your control. And it could be that this 40-year-old is in a lower tax bracket. So it might make sense to pay it off and take the money out of the 401k and pay your tax, because you're already in a low bracket and may not cost you a lot. The other thing is the timing might be right? The markets have done so well, and if you've invested well and you emotionally, if it will just create havoc in your brain if it starts to go down, if you're in that situation. And then you get in the coulda, shoulda, woulda, wish I did type of scenario. So what I would suggest, and then there's taxes to pay, and I hope they're less, but what I would suggest is that you, talk to somebody like a banker or an advisor or somebody that you feel confident in, or if you do feel like it's the right thing to do, then it's the right thing to do, and then there's no looking back, right? And then the last thing I'll say is the emotional feel that people have. We live through all these people's lives for decades of time, and I can't help but ride up with them and ride down with them. It's something that you have to just decide and then deal with it, because I do believe that emotionally you're probably going to be better off by just taking it and just paying it off. Bruce?
Yeah, and just to add to that, and I agree, Peg, but and I'm glad that you also acknowledge the emotional aspect that they put it in when they wrote it. And here's what I mean by that. So here's an example. I'm going to kind of make up some numbers. But let's say that you can – earlier in the show, we talked about lost opportunity cost. And what that means is – and in the text, they didn't say what interest rate they're paying on their debt. They said they have $32,000 worth of debt. Well, the answer that I give about paying them off, paying that off could change dramatically based on what's the debt service rate. I mean, if the debt is at 5 or 6%, I might give a different answer than it's at 12, if it's 12 or 14%. So first, you have to look at the cost of the debt service. Then you say, okay, if I'm going to take money out of a retirement plan that's been averaging 10% a year, and I'm going to pay off a loan at 6, I would say there's a lost opportunity cost in doing that, and plus you're going to pay taxes if you take it out of that plan. And plus, if you're 40 years old, there might be a 10% premature distribution penalty. So I might look at that and say, economically, that doesn't make sense. But they might say, but this weight of this debt is killing me. It keeps me up at night. I have trouble functioning. I feel a weight on my shoulders. And if paying off the debt takes all that away, even if economically, to me, it doesn't make sense, I would say do it. Absolutely, you should do it. And then, like you said, Peg, don't look back. Don't second guess. Don't Monday morning quarterback. You made your decision. Now let's move forward. But it's both an economic question and an emotional question. Now, on the other hand, if that debt service is 12 or 14% or really onerous, then it makes it easier for me to say, yes, absolutely, we should take some of your gains out of your investments, take those winnings off the table, and pay down that onerous debt. But the one component missing from the question that would have given me maybe more insight is, what is the cost of the debt service? But again, great question. A lot of people probably find themselves in a similar situation that are listening right now. And you know, we're always happy to try to help those people, you know, if they want to talk to us. Susie?
651-461-9226. We've got about 5 minutes left together. A texter writes, I was recently laid off. I'm 58 years old. Wants to know about the 55 rule for withdrawal of 401k. We're having a lot of 401k questions today. All right, so laid off at 58 years old, wants to know about the 55 rule for withdrawal of the 401k. Bruce, Peg?
Yeah, again, that's a great question. And again, it's an astute listener that's asking the question, Peg, because a lot of people don't even know about this possibility of tapping into retirement plans between 55 and 59 and a half without a penalty. But before I throw it to you to answer it, I just want to comment. You know, we talk a lot on the show about how GDP is strong, unemployment is low, the stock market's been great, the economy's been good. But I've been seeing a lot of things lately about downsizing and layoffs and whatnot, so I'm not totally surprised by the texture, but I'm seeing some evidence that's contrary to, you know, our kind of optimistic viewpoint that there are a lot of companies right now that are cutting back and streamlining, and so I'm not surprised by the question. Peg, getting distribution, getting access to your money after the age of 55, but you're not yet 59 and a half.
Yeah, the first thing that came to mind is in some cases, there is a rule within your corporation, and it's usually federal employees, that if you're 55 and older, you can take withdrawals without the 10% penalty. So just in case you're federal. Then if you're working for a corporation, the IRS actually has a regulation that says, okay, you have access to your 401k at 55, but you do have to go through an amortization schedule that the IRS dictates how much you can take per year and over a length of time. And so we run those amortization schedules for people to know, you know, how much are you allowed to take without the 10% penalty, and then how long does it go? There's some real details to this that you have to be careful about how you utilize it, because if you do it wrong, then it'll all fast forward and you'll all get taxed and you'll get the 10% penalty. So I don't take this provision lightly. You do need to work with somebody, either your employer, your past employer, or a financial advisor, or somebody that you know that could help you see if this is a good option. Bruce?
Yeah, and that's a great answer. And what I'm going to add doesn't really add to the answer. It's just kind of overarching over the entire question. And that is that, you know, when you have a company retirement plan, 401k or whatever it is, that's your money in that plan, but it's your employer's plan. And they can do what they want to do with their plan within the, you know, the legal provisions, you know, allowed by the government. So your money, their plan, they have some control over your money. And then the other thing, the overarching thing is there are opportunities maybe in some situations to access money before you're 59 and a half without a penalty. This is one of them. Another one that comes to mind is Regulation 72T and an IRA. But again, you got to really, really be careful. But just so listeners know, sometimes you can get at your money without a detrimental impact before 59 and a half, but be careful. Susie, can we sneak in one more, or are we too late?
No, I think we can. You can probably get this one. Do you know of any special allowances concerning Roth conversions for the year coming up?
Special allowances, Roth conversion. Peg, I'm not sure what they mean by that. Thoughts?
I don't know either. I guess I don't know if they're asking about the dollar amount that you can do. I mean, you can do conversions up to a very large amount. I mean, I had a client do $1 million.
Oh, okay.
In a conversion from, yeah. So I don't know what restrictions or what they're asking about.
I have a quick allowance. Another one, just so you know, Bruce, is what is the age you have to do an RMD?
Okay, RMD is age 73 right now, and that's going to be changing. They're going to extend that going forward. And I think the Roth thing, they might have been talking about the difference between making a contribution versus a conversion. Contribution, there's income limitations. Conversion, you can make as much as you want. It doesn't matter. You just have to be able to pay the tax when you do the conversion. And now I know you're out of time.
Because we're getting the music. Hey, have a great week, you guys. Good to talk to you. Again, we didn't get to everyone. So if you have a question, you want to email it, yourmoneyatwealthenhancement.com. That's yourmoneyatwealthenhancement.com or 1-888-6-ADVICE. Make it a great week.